This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, the perfect treehouse for adults. But first,
I'm Amber Hunt, and this is Accused, the unsolved murder of Elizabeth Andes. On the last episode,
my dad came up to me and he said, "Sue," he said, "they think it was Bob." And I just remember going, "No," like that, and just like hitting my dad's chest, like totally freaked out.
If she had lived and we had stayed in contact, and we were both free, that I think we might have gone out and something might have transpired.
A few days after she graduated from Miami University in December 1978, Elizabeth Andes was found dead in her Oxford apartment by her boyfriend, Robert Young. Police quickly homed in on Young as their prime suspect, and after extensive questioning, he confessed. For police and prosecutors, it was an open and shut case, but Young recanted the confession, saying he was tired, traumatized, and confused. Two separate juries, one criminal, the other civil, found him not guilty of the crime. Oxford police refused to reopen the case, insisting the juries were wrong and that Young got away with murder. For family and friends of the 23-year-old woman, questions linger to this day about her death. Cincinnati Inquirer journalists Amber Hunt and Amanda Rossman have spent a year looking into the 37-year-old cold case. They join us this afternoon to discuss the podcast detailing their investigation, Accused, the Unsolved Murder of Elizabeth Andes. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Amanda and Amber, thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Amber, how did you and Amanda become involved in this story? How did it first come to your attention?
Well, it came about the same way most stories come about that you don't come up with yourself. At least an editor handed me a folder that had this bit about the case in it, and it was at first just going to be some kind of small, you know, maybe a Sunday story. It wasn't going to be a huge investigation, but as we started digging into it, it got bigger and bigger, and then eventually we decided it was actually a podcast.
So why reinvestigate the case, though? I mean, the more you looked at it, what started to change your mind and made you decide this was something that needed to have an extensive investigation done?
Because they didn't do it. I mean, the police did not do the kind of investigation that you expect police to do at the beginning after finding a dead body. They decided that this one person did it. And even after two different juries said, no, I don't think so, they did not look at other people. I think we felt pretty comfortable that we had a bigger story when we sat down with the former police chief from Oxford. He told us he still thinks that Bob Young did it. And if there had been anybody else worth looking at, he would have looked at them. Well, we found other people worth looking at.
Well, in a violent crime like this, there's that old adage that it's usually somebody that you know, someone you're close to, not a stranger, that commits an act that is this violent. And is that why police were so quick to think it was Bob?
Well, I think the confession, you know, really, really supported that for him to confess to this murder. Police can't get past that, you know, especially the police at the time. Why would you confess to something that you didn't do?
But it reached the level to get to a confession because, of course, when they have a live body, they have a dead body. They're going to look at the living one to see if they're responsible first. And then you step out from there and you start looking at more and more people. But they never got past that first person. And part of the reason was because after 15 hours of interrogating, he ended up confessing. But we know now what we didn't know in 78, which is, you know, the longer an interrogation goes, the more likely a false confession. They recommend not going past 3 hours if you're hoping for an honest confession. This was 15.
Well, it's interesting, too, that you had a criminal case. The jury found him not guilty. Then in a civil case, they found where the burden of proof is actually lower.
Way lower.
Yeah.
They found him not liable for her death. And yet the police had this confession. What exactly happened? I mean, did the defense attorney just do a good job of using that confession and saying, wait a minute, this thing was really flawed?
Well, luckily for Bob, a lot of what he said was not accurate. It didn't match the crime scene. So there were details that the defense lawyer was able to line up. And Bob said, you know, I used pantyhose to tie up one part of her body. And, well, there were no pantyhose used. And there were things like... In Bob's confession, he said that he had strangled her first, and then stabbed her and then tied her up. But there are actually stab cuts into the ligatures, which means that they had to be in place before the stabs happened.
And also there's a timeline element
that
really helped Bob.
Yeah.
So he was supposed to leave his home in Fairborn around 8 o'clock. And this would have happened. He made the phone call to 911 around 9:36. So he would have had maybe 15 minutes, according to police, to kill her, clean himself up, call police, well, actually even get worked up enough to kill her.
Yeah, and it doesn't match what would have had to have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me about this couple. Tell me about Elizabeth Andes and Bob Young.
So Elizabeth was really spunky, and it kind of kills me every time I talk to one of her friends because I'm like, oh, I would have liked her. I really would have. She was headstrong. She was just kind of she was cooler than I have ever hoped to be. But she was a cool chick, and she, you know, she was looking to start a career after college. She wasn't going to do the stay-at-home mom thing. And Bob was like a quiet geology major, football player type who was totally down with the ERA. Like he was really supportive of her life goals. What was confusing to her friends was that the theory that police presented and prosecutors presented at the trial was that because they had graduated college, they were going to have to break up. And as far as her friends know, that conversation never happened. They were going to take their separate jobs, and they were going to see how it worked out.
Did you actually get a chance to talk to Bob Young in your investigation?
Mm-hmm. We did.
Yeah, tell us about what he had to say.
He's still as soft-spoken as
right.
He seems to have been back then. He has a hard time explaining how the confession came about. Part of it, he knows, is shock. I mean, he never expected to see what he saw that day. And it was particularly brutal. I mean, every murder is terrible. But this one was bloody, and it was really rough to see. And on top of that, he was being told, well, you might have done it, but you might have blocked it out. Maybe you don't remember. Or, you know, sometimes people who do this stuff in a fit of rage, they get out in 2 years. So he was really in this position where he just didn't know what was real anymore. He was exhausted. And of course, it threw the investigation off once he confessed, so he regrets it.
He had his record sealed after the civil case, didn't he?
Right. He did.
So did he actually reopen the records for you so you could look into them as part of your examination?
He did. He's been very helpful along this process.
He started with, there's a lawyer in Cincinnati named Deb Leiden who's been working on behalf of the Andes family. She's working for free. He started by cooperating with her. She reached out to him and said, they being the Butler County officials, aren't letting us look at the case files because they say they could get legally in trouble because you've had them sealed. Bob said, no problem. He signed an affidavit loosening the restrictions. And then when we got involved, we still weren't getting a lot of cooperation from Butler County. So we made a point to write up a statement that he read and signed on camera where he says, Butler officials and Oxford officials can talk to the Cincinnati Inquirer about everything to do with my case because he wants it solved.
So what kind of reaction have you gotten to this investigation? I mean, first off, what's the family think of this, Elizabeth's family?
They've been very supportive. They just want this solved. So
this has been really lucky on that front, yeah.
Right.
Because they didn't want to... They didn't talk to us where we were recording. Once we realized we were doing a podcast, they asked that their voices not be used just because they didn't know how it would be taken, and they didn't want people sort of analyzing how they sounded and do they sound grieved enough and all of that. But all along the way, I've kept in contact with them. I've sent them questions when I had some middle of the night epiphany, like, did this happen or that happen? And they have always, always responded. And now I think they're actually hopeful for the first time in a while.
Now, I have to think this has just been horribly frustrating for them.
Right.
37 years without knowing what happened to your daughter who killed her, that has to be terribly frustrating for her.
I can't imagine what they've gone through.
Yeah. What about the police themselves? I mean, what kind of reaction have you gotten from them to doing this?
Well, there are sort of two camps. Mm-hmm. There's the investigators from then, and then there are investigators now. The investigators from then are not very responsive.
No.
I can't imagine they're too keen on this.
They don't know why we're wasting our time.
No.
I think, so.
Yeah. And you hear in the podcast, I mean, we've got those reactions included because they, you know, one declines to speak to me. The investigators today have been a little bit more receptive. Up until recently, I haven't heard from them in a while, in a few weeks. And so we're hoping that that's because they are very hard at work.
So you say investigators today, do they view this as an unsolved case at this point?
Yes.
I think at this point they do now.
Yeah.
So what's it been like for you to investigate this for the past year? Tell me about the process that you've gone through and how tough and the challenges that you faced and how much work has gone into this.
Well, it's 37 years later, so you can imagine it's a little harder to find some people. It's a little harder to track things down.
Right. So for me as an investigative reporter, I've had to look up people who didn't want to be found, and it's always tricky, but this one is beyond tricky because, I mean, the suspect's name, the original suspect, was Bob Young. And that's pretty much indicative of the kind of names that are involved throughout the case. There are like 1,400 Roberts in this case. And so trying to find, they don't live in Ohio anymore, most of them. So trying to find them after all these years has been really, really difficult. But we have been surprised at our success. Amanda is
These are people that even the police were having a hard time finding.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah. And Amanda's gotten amazingly good. If I need anybody on Facebook, she finds it in like 4 seconds, which is just, I don't know.
Yeah, tracking people down. Yeah. I'm good at locating people.
Yeah, it's been really interesting from that perspective.
And those that we couldn't find, we knocked on some doors.
Yeah, and we ended up finding them too. I mean, we've really tracked down a lot of people.
What did Bob Young think when he found out you were reinvestigating this case?
That was kind of a strange courtship almost, because I didn't want to go to him first, partly because if he is guilty, we were open to that. We didn't walk into this thinking that he had been exonerated rightly. It very well could have been that the jury got it wrong. So we did a lot of other research first. And then kind of circled around Bob. And then we started interviewing people who knew Bob. And then we knew that they were talking to him about us. And we heard even that it was like on a first name basis. Have you talked to Amber this weekend? You know? And so it was very bizarre. Once I finally called him, it was like, you know, two people who knew each other just finally connecting. He's always known that if we found something that would point to him, that we were going to report the heck out of that too. And he wasn't afraid of that, because the only thing that he knew we would find is the confession.
Yeah, according to his friends, he had spent years not really talking about this. So I think we were one of the first that he even shared his story with.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and this is the WVXU and WMUB Fall Fund Drive. If you haven't had a chance to contribute yet, take just a few minutes to do so by making a phone call to 513-419-7155. You can also contribute online very quickly and very easily at WVXU.org or WMUB.org. Cincinnati Inquirer journalist Amber Hunt and Amanda Rossman have spent a year looking into the cold case surrounding the 1978 murder of Miami University graduate Elizabeth Andes. And they join us this afternoon to discuss their podcast detailing their investigation, Accused, the Unsolved Murder of Elizabeth Andes. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, Amber, why did the Inquirer decide to do this as a podcast? Was there just a lot of detail and a lot of sound to incorporate into the story?
Well, like I said, we started out looking at it as a story, but it ended up being so complicated that at first we were thinking, okay, maybe it's a few stories, it'll be like a series, and maybe we'll have a couple of podcast episodes just accompanying it. But then the more we mapped it out, the more we realized that this is designed for the podcast type audience. It's very rich. There are a lot of voices. So we just ended up recording pretty much everything we did and picking and choosing as we edited.
Now, we've got 6 episodes, I think, of the podcast have come out so far.
Right.
What's been the reaction to those so far?
We have more than 250,000 listens on SoundCloud, which was staggering for us, considering we just started coming out 2.5 weeks ago. We've been a high of number 15 on iTunes. It's been really, really well received, especially because, I mean, we've never done a podcast before, and the Inquirer has only dabbled. So this was a new kind of, it's been amazing, the response.
Has it generated any new leads in the case?
It has.
Okay.
Yeah, and we said in the very first episode that our goal, because we really, like, it was very important to me, especially, to be very transparent about what we were doing and why we were doing it. I even want, you know, I fought to keep in my terse interviews so that people, if they thought that I was too hard on somebody, that they were getting an honest portrayal of how this all went down. So we said in the first episode that we wanted to solve this thing, and we have gotten a lot of response. Some of it is, you know, oh, I think such and such happened because it makes sense. But some of them are people who knew Beth. So we're still doing interviews.
Now, one of the podcasts, you bring up something called the Addict Letter. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what that was.
It was a letter delivered, well, postmarked back in March.
March 1979.
Right before the criminal trial, Bob's criminal trial. It went to his lawyer. It said,
"You must get Bob freed."
I did it.
Yeah, he didn't
30
kill
minutes,
Andes.
Yeah, 30 minutes prior to Bob's arrival. $40 wasn't much, but I needed a fix badly.
Right. Okay, so somebody's admitting it to it, but the problem is they don't have a return address or a name on the letter, right? Or the envelope.
It was postmarked from Dayton, Ohio, but that's as much as we've got.
Yeah. Yeah, so we don't know if that's somebody who read about it in the newspaper and thought, well, Bob doesn't sound guilty, so I'm just going to throw something out there, or if it's somebody who actually did it and is being honest in the letter. There are so many little mysteries in this case that it's maddening.
Also, something that you bring up in the podcast, you mentioned this is the late 1970s when this is going on. And this, as you say in the podcast, was a very dark time in American history in terms of crime. Any thoughts on whether Elizabeth might have been a victim of one of the many serial killers that was roaming the country during that time period?
We do analyze that. We take a pretty deep look at that in one of the episodes. And it wasn't just that there were a lot of serial killers in the country, because we can all remember John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy and all of that. But it's also that in the Cincinnati area specifically, we had women disappearing, their bodies being found, some of them strangled. And most of them would be looked at in conjunction. They would say, oh, there's, you know, we need to compare this to this other woman. But Beth, because they zeroed in on her boyfriend so quickly, she was never looked at that way. She was never looked to see if, you know, the MO was similar.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us, and let's talk with Pat in Fairborn. Hi, Pat.
I got a lot of that during the recording of the podcast.
Now, Pat was actually saying he knew somebody in he knew the Young family.
Oh, okay.
And that apparently there was somebody else they were thinking about at the time, or there was somebody else who was suspected at the time.
I would be interested in talking to him if he'd like to find me. That would be fine. I suspect that we have looked at a couple of those people. and they're probably outlined already in the podcast. We spend episodes 4 and 5 looking at some alternate folks.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. What about the odds of this case ever being reopened? You get any indications from the police that this that might ever happen?
I feel comfortable saying the case is open now.
Mm-hmm.
As far as you're concerned.
Yeah, they are actively, last we heard, they are actively working on it.
Yeah.
And you're hoping this podcast series is going to spur other people to come forward.
Right.
Yeah, because you never know who's sitting on some information that they don't realize is important. Or maybe they have that one key and they were afraid to come forward. They didn't want to get involved. Well, you know, this is a real person and her family is still dealing with the repercussions of her loss. So my hope is that by spreading the story, we'll reach the right person who has that key piece of info.
What's been the most surprising thing to each of you as you've done this investigation?
That we were the first to talk to some people after 37 years.
Yeah. I mean, there were people who had fought with this woman the day before she died. And aside from being asked where they were that night, they weren't really talked to. And we were told that, oh, I'd really like to talk to so-and-so, but I can't find them. And then we found them. So that's what's been the most surprising and rewarding, I guess.
Amber, what was crime like in Oxford at that time? This was pretty much a shock when this happened, wasn't
right.
it? Because it wasn't you didn't see murders or violent crime in Oxford.
No. And I'm always careful because, you know, oh, they were surprised it happened here. That's such a common refrain whenever something violent happens. But this city, really, I mean, they had one murder in a quarter century. It's a very safe place to live. So this was very unusual, and it was new for the detectives involved to have to look into solving a murder.
So you got several more episodes of the podcast yet to come.
Two more to come.
Two planned. Okay. Maybe another if
we're hoping.
Yeah, fingers
okay.
crossed.
But as far as the investigation, your investigation itself goes, where do you head from here?
We'll keep diving into these leads and talking to people as they come forward.
I'm keeping a list of all the leads that are coming in, and I'm making a database, and we'll see what happens from there.
So it's gone on for a year at this point. How much longer do you think it goes on?
Until it's solved, or I guess we're dead.
You're that committed to this.
Yeah. I mean, these people, they're having to deal with this every day. The least I can do is
her family.
Yeah. The least I can do is keep a tally of the info.
They've gotten to run around for years. I mean,
yeah,
they deserve some answers.
Well, Amanda and Amber, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Amber Hunt and Amanda Rossman with the Cincinnati Inquirer. And you can find a link to their podcast, Accused, The Unsolved Murder of Elizabeth Andes, at WVXU.org. Coming up, we'll hear about tree houses for adults and, in focus on technology, training new doctors about the role that diet plays in staying healthy. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.